This COE is based on the New York State appellate decisions addressing civil procedure issues that were released in March of 2020. The decisions were summarized on the New York Appellate Digest website, and those summaries have since been compiled into the March 2020 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet, and it's that pamphlet which forms the written materials for this CLE course, and the page references are to that pamphlet. The first case is on page 4, Durham Commercial Capital Corporation. It's a conflict of laws case, 4th Department, held that Supreme Court properly ruled that Georgia law controlled the action which alleged Bank of America's employees or agents notarized documents with false signatures. The torts were alleged to have occurred in Georgia. Plaintiff was a domiciliary of New York, and Bank of America was a domiciliary of North Carolina. The court wrote, "If the conflicting laws regulate conduct, the law of the place of the tort applies because of the locus jurisdiction's interests in protecting the reasonable expectations of the parties, and the admonitory effect that applying its law will have on similar conduct in the future. Whereas here, however, the conflicting laws relate to the allocation of losses, then considerations of the state's admonitory interest and party reliance are less important. Nevertheless, pursuant to the third rule set forth in Neumeier v. Kuhner, that's 31 New York 2nd 121, that is, where the parties are domiciled in different states with conflicting laws, the law of the place of the tort normally applies, unless displacing it will advance the relevant substantive law purposes without impairing the smooth working of the multistate system or producing great uncertainty for litigants. We conclude that plaintiff failed to establish that the exception applies to warrant a departure from the locus jurisdiction rule, and thus the third Neumeier rule warrants the application of the law of Georgia in this action." Next, still on page 4, is matter of Aaron F. It deals with a discrepancy between a decision and a related order. The Fourth Department noted a discrepancy between the decision and the order, and therefore the order was conformed to the decision. The court wrote, "We note that in its bench decision, Family Court determined that the child was derivatively neglected. Inasmuch as there's a conflict between the decision and the order, that order must be conformed to the decision," and it cites CPLR 5019 subdivision A. "We therefore modify the order by vacating that part of the order determining that the child was derivatively abused and substituting, therefore, a determination that the child was derivatively neglected." So again, where there's a conflict between the decision and a related order, the decision controls. Next on page 5 is matter of Williams versus Richardson. It has to do with the appearance of an attorney without the client. Court wrote, "The Fourth Department determined father was not in default because his attorney appeared. Therefore, the custody order was appealable." The court said, "We agree with the father that Family Court erred in entering the order upon his default based on his failure to appear in court. The record establishes that the father was represented by counsel, and we have previously determined that where a party fails to appear in court on a scheduled date, but is represented by counsel, the order is not one entered upon default of the aggrieved party, and the appeal is therefore not precluded." And the underlying rule there is judgments procured by default are generally not appealable. Next is Berman. On pages 5 and 6, it deals with the criteria for a preliminary injunction. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held Supreme Court should not have ordered the return of the down payment to the buyer, whose name was Berman, pursuant to the purchase contract in the context of granting a preliminary injunction. First, by granting the ultimate relief requested, Supreme Court had effectively granted summary judgment before issue was joined. Second, the criteria for a preliminary injunction were not met. The purchase contract allowed the termination of the agreement and the return of the down payment if three conditions were met. Berman alleged two of the conditions were met, and the third was impossible. The court wrote, Berman failed to demonstrate his entitlement to temporary injunctive relief pursuant to CPLR 6301, as he failed to establish any of the three required elements for that relief. 1. Likelihood of ultimate success on the merits. 2. Irreparable injury absent granting of a preliminary injunction. And 3. A balancing of equities in his favor. Berman failed to demonstrate irreparable injury, as the loss of a down payment is not an irreparable harm since the injured party could be made whole by a money judgment. While Berman contends that it was impossible to obtain a Phase 2 assessment within the required time, which apparently was required by the contract, he failed to demonstrate a likelihood of success in establishing that it was impossible to obtain the report. And finally, Berman failed to show that the balancing of equities was in his favor. Next is Matter of Barbeau on page 6. It has to do with a sua sponte action by a judge. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have sua sponte dismissed causes of action for lack of standing when that issue was not raised by the parties. The court said, we conclude that the court erred in sua sponte reaching the issue of standing with respect to the second and third causes of action. Standing is an aspect of justiciability which, when challenged, must be considered at the outset of any litigation. Inasmuch as the respondent's cross-motion with respect to the second and third causes of action was not based on petitioner's alleged lack of standing, there was no basis for the court to reach that issue. Next on page 7 is Board of Managers of Gulfview Condominium 1. It's another case involving a sua sponte action taken by a judge. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the judge should not have, sua sponte, appointed a receiver and should not have referred an issue to a court attorney referee in this dispute between plaintiff condominium boards and homeowners association. The court wrote, the Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in sua sponte appointing a receiver to manage the plaintiff entities, since the complaint did not seek the appointment of a receiver. No person having an apparent interest in the plaintiff entity sought such relief, and there's no evidence that such a drastic remedy was warranted, and it's citing CPLR 6401 subdivision A. Next is Matter of Pittsford Canalside Properties. It deals with a dispute between a town and a developer and an attempt to reach an agreement, an enforceable settlement agreement. And it also deals with the powers of a judge to direct what a town can do in this context. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held 1. The correspondence between the property owner, PCP, and the town concerning proposed construction created an agreement to agree, not an enforceable settlement agreement allowing construction. And 2. Supreme Court's directing what the town could and could not consider with respect to the construction project encroached upon the town's administrative authority. The court wrote, the letters that the court found to have memorialized the settlement agreement did not contain all the material terms of the settlement and constituted no more than an agreement to agree. The town stated therein only that it was now in a position to agree to a settlement of the mass and scale issues, but that first it would need to receive, review, and approve all of the items that it normally reviews in connection with any application it receives. Any agreement was further conditioned on the town's receipt of additional documentation from PCP, including an accurate-to-scale site plan and further roof specifications. We further conclude that in the absence of an enforceable settlement agreement, the court's hearing on the issues of mass and scale, subsequent decision rendering findings of fact related to PCP's new application for a certificate of approval, and remittal to the town for consideration of that application with specific directives regarding what the town could and could not consider were impermissible intrusions into respondents' administrative domain, into the town's administrative domain. So absent an enforceable settlement agreement, the judge's attempt to dictate what the town could do encroached on the town's authority in this development matter. Next is a matter of Hampshire Recreation, which is on page 9. It's another case that deals with the authority of a municipal government, this time a village. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the village board properly declined to consider an application to rezone the subject property, which was an exercise of a legislative function. Here, there was an Article 78 attempting to rezone some property. The court wrote, "The amendment of a zoning ordinance is a purely legislative function. The village board is vested with discretion to amend its zoning ordinance, and it is not required to consider and vote upon every application for a zoning change, citing Village Law 7-708. Thus, in the present case, the village board's determinations not to consider the plaintiff's petitioner's applications were a legislative function not subject to review under CPLR Article 78. So a municipality need not consider an application pursuant to CPLR Article 78, which seeks the amendment of a zoning ordinance. Next is U.S. Bank Trust on page 9. It deals with the concept of necessary parties in the context of a motion to dismiss. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that the motion to dismiss for failure to name a necessary party should not have been granted. Rather, the court should have ordered the party summoned. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court should have denied that branch of defendant's motion, which was pursuant to CPLR 3211, to dismiss the complaint insofar as asserted against her for failure to join the estate as a defendant. When a necessary party has not been made a party and is subject to the jurisdiction of the court shall order him summoned." That's quoting from CPLR 1001, subdivision B. "Accordingly, we remit the matter for the joinder of the administrator of the estate and for further proceedings consistent herewith." So as long as a necessary party is within the jurisdiction of the court, the failure to include that party should not result in dismissal. Rather, the court can summon the party itself. Next is Riskin on page 10. It has to do with the status of a case after the note of issue has been vacated. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that vacating the note of issue automatically removes the case from the trial calendar and restores the action to the pre-note of issue discovery stage. The Second Department also held the motion to extend the time to file a note of issue, citing law office failure, should have been granted. The court wrote, "The Supreme Court should have denied as unnecessary that branch of the plaintiff's motion, which was to restore the action to the active calendar. Since the note of issue was vacated, thereafter the action was restored to the pre-note of issue discovery stage. Because no note of issue had been filed, the action was not on the trial calendar. Therefore, the court's action of marking the action disposed after the plaintiff failed to file and serve a note of issue by the court-ordered deadline did not dismiss the action. For the same reason, contrary to the defendant's contention, CPLR 3404 was inapplicable. As this action was never properly dismissed, there was no need for a motion to restore. The Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying that branch of the plaintiff's motion, which was to extend his time to file a note of issue. CPLR 2004 allows a court to extend the time fixed by any statute, rule, or order for doing any act upon such terms as may be just and upon good cause shown. Here the plaintiff established good cause for his delay in completing discovery and filing a note of issue based on law office failure, among other things. Next is Cohen Brothers Realty on pages 10 and 11. It deals with the pleading requirements for fraud and civil conspiracy. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiffs had stated a cause of action for fraud and properly alleged a related civil conspiracy. Plaintiffs are owners of commercial buildings, and defendants included an employee of one of the plaintiffs and several contractors who did work for the plaintiffs. Plaintiffs alleged invoices for work were inflated and the excess payments were split among the defendants. With respect to the fraud and civil conspiracy causes of action, the First Department wrote this. To state a cause of action for fraud, a plaintiff must allege a material misrepresentation of a fact, knowledge of its falsity, an intent to induce reliance, justifiable reliance by the plaintiff, and damages. Such a claim must be pleaded with particularity, citing CPLR 3016 subdivision B. Actual knowledge, however, need only be pleaded generally, given particularly at the pre-discovery stage that a plaintiff lacks access to the very discovery materials which would illuminate a defendant's state of mind. Here we find that plaintiffs sufficiently pleaded fraud causes of action with the information available to them in a pre-discovery posture. They allege the creation and presentation for payment to plaintiffs of false, forged, or inflated purchase orders, that defendants knew that the work described on the bogus purchase orders or invoices and other contract forms was either falsely stated, overcharged, or not provided, and knew that plaintiffs would rely on these falsified or doctored purchase orders to make unwarranted payments. The plaintiffs relied on these purchase orders, invoices, and other contract forms in making unnecessary payments to defendants to their detriment, that such reliance was justifiable and reasonable, and that plaintiffs were damaged as a result of defendants' fraud. After discovery, plaintiffs can amplify their pleadings and defendants can renew their motions, but at this stage, plaintiffs should be allowed to probe defendants' knowledge of the alleged fraudulent scheme. Although New York does not recognize an independent cause of action for civil conspiracy, allegations of civil conspiracy are permitted to connect the actions of separate defendants with an otherwise actionable tort. To establish a claim of civil conspiracy, the plaintiff must demonstrate the primary tort plus the following four elements: an agreement between two or more parties, an overt act in furtherance of the agreement, the party's intentional participation in the furtherance of a plan or purpose, and resulting damage or injury. Plaintiffs pleaded the underlying fraud against defendants, as well as an agreement that defendants acted in concert and conspired to defraud plaintiffs' business. As a result, plaintiffs were damaged because they paid monies to the defendants for non-existent, unnecessary, and/or overpriced construction and maintenance services. So although there's no separate tort in New York for civil conspiracy, the conspiracy theory can be alleged to link several defendants who committed fraud. Next is Bank of New York on page 12. It's a foreclosure case. Second Department held the referee's failure to provide notice and a hearing to the defendant in this foreclosure action did not require reversal of the judgment of foreclosure. The court wrote, "It's undisputed that the referee failed to provide notice to the defendant pursuant to CPLR 4313 or to hold a hearing on the issues addressed in the referee's report. However, as long as a defendant is not prejudiced by the inability to submit evidence directly to the referee, a referee's failure to notify a defendant and hold a hearing is not by itself a basis to reverse a judgment of foreclosure and sale and remit the matter for a hearing and a new determination of amounts owed. Whereas here, a defendant had an opportunity to raise questions and submit evidence directly to the Supreme Court, which evidence could be considered by the court in determining whether to confirm the referee's report, the defendant is not prejudiced by any error in failing to hold a hearing. Next is Deutsche Bank on pages 12 and 13. It's another foreclosure case, this time dealing with the attempt to restore the action. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff bank should have been allowed to restore a 2009 foreclosure action which had been administratively but not formally dismissed. The court noted that the bank's prior statement of its intention to discontinue the 2009 action did not trigger the judicial estoppel doctrine. The court wrote, while in an effort to successfully prosecute the 2015 foreclosure action, the bank represented that it would seek to discontinue the 2009 action, it is not judicially estopped from changing its position. A party who assumes a certain position in a prior legal proceeding and secures a favorable judgment is precluded from assuming a contrary position in another action simply because his or her interests have changed. The bank did not obtain a favorable judgment in the 2015 foreclosure action. The Supreme Court should have granted that branch of the bank's motion, which was to restore the 2009 action to the active calendar. The 2009 action was never formally dismissed, as the marking off procedures of CPLR 3404 do not apply to pre-note of issue actions such as this one. Since the 2009 action could not properly be marked off pursuant to CPLR 3404, the bank was not required to move to restore within any specified time frame and was not obligated to demonstrate a reasonable excuse and a potentially meritorious claim. Next is Edwards Blackburn on pages 13 and 14. It has to do with the adequacy of service of process. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held a hearing should have been held about the validity of the service of the summons and complaint, that is, whether service on the doorman of the defendant's, that's Freeman's, apartment building was valid service. The court wrote, the plaintiff asserted that service of process was properly made pursuant to CPLR 308 subdivision 2, relying on an affidavit of service indicated that service upon Freeman was effected by delivering the summons and complaint to a doorman in the apartment building where Freeman resided, and by subsequently mailing the summons and complaint to Freeman. While the affidavit of service constituted prima facie evidence of service of the summons and complaint pursuant to CPLR 308 subdivision 2, the evidence submitted by Freeman in support of her motion to dismiss the complaint sufficiently rebutted the presumption of proper service to warrant a hearing. Freeman's submissions included specific and detailed averments, as well as the affidavit of a security guard who worked in Freeman's apartment building. The security guard averred that the summons and complaint were delivered to him at his desk, but that he was not authorized to receive packages or deliveries, that he did not deny the process server access to Freeman's apartment, and that he did not inform Freeman of the delivery. Under these circumstances, the court should have conducted a hearing to determine whether the security guard was a person of suitable age and discretion within the meaning of CPLR 308 subdivision 2, and whether the outer bounds of Freeman's dwelling place extended to the security guard's desk at her apartment building. Next is LaChase Construction on page 14, another service of process case. The Fourth Department held defendant did not rebut the presumption of valid service of process. The court wrote, plaintiff submitted, in addition to evidence establishing the default of defendant and proof of the facts constituting the claim, citing CPLR 3215 subdivision F, the affidavit of a process server who averred that he served defendant by delivering a copy of the summons and complaint to the office of the Secretary of State pursuant to Business Corporation Law, section 306 subdivision B1. And an affidavit of additional mailing establishing that a copy of the summons and complaint was also sent to defendant's mailing address pursuant to CPLR 3215 subdivision G4. In opposition, defendant asserted that it was entitled under CPLR 317 to be relieved from its default in pleading, and defendant submitted an affidavit in which its president averred, insofar as relevant to the issue of service, that defendant had not received the summons and complaint prior to receipt of plaintiff's initial notice of motion for a default judgment. In order to be relieved of a default in pleading under CPLR 317, defendant was required to show, among other things, that it did not receive actual notice of process in time to defend the action. It is well settled that a process server's affidavit constitutes prima facie evidence of proper service on the Secretary of State, and thus defendant was required to rebut the presumption of proper service. Here, the self-serving affidavit of defendant's president, which merely denied receipt, is insufficient to rebut that presumption. Next is Sanchez on page 15, spoliation case. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the city defendants should have been sanctioned for spoliation of evidence. The action stemmed from a traffic accident involving a police vehicle, and the city defendants were put on notice they would assert an emergency defense by the notice of claim. But the pre-accident police communications were not preserved. The court wrote, defendants had an obligation to preserve the pre-accident audio recordings at the time they were destroyed because the police department internal report and plaintiff's notice of claim, which attached the public police accident report, put defendants on notice that they would likely assert an emergency operation defense. Therefore, pre-accident audio communication between the dispatcher and the NYPD vehicle or officers involved in the accident should have been preserved in case it was needed for future litigation. Under the circumstances presented, the imposition of an adverse inference charge would be an appropriate sanction. Next is 159 MP Corporation on pages 15 and 16. It's a land use and zoning case involving the issue of whether a party has standing to contest a zoning ruling. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff did not have standing to contest the defendant city's issuing permits allowing defendant CAB to convert property from manufacturing to retail. Plaintiff operated a grocery store 450 feet from CAB's property. The Second Department held proximity was not enough to confer standing on the plaintiff. The court wrote, in land use matters, the plaintiff must show that it would suffer direct harm, injury that is in some way different from that of the public at large. An allegation of close proximity may give rise to an inference of damage or injury that enables a nearby property owner to challenge a land use decision without proof of actual injury. However, this does not entitle the property owner to judicial review in every instance. Rather, in addition to establishing that the effect of the proposed change is different from that suffered by the public generally, the property owner must establish that the interest asserted is arguably within the zone of interests the statute protects. Thus, even where the property owner's premises are physically close to the subject property, an ad hoc determination may be required as to whether a particular property owner itself has a legally protectable interest so as to confer standing. Here, the plaintiff alleged standing on the basis of proximity, issues and interests within the zone of interests, and adverse impacts. We disagree with Supreme Court's finding that the plaintiff had standing to commence the action. The plaintiff failed to allege any harm distinct from that of the community at large. Next is Deutsche Bank, pages 16 and 17. It's a foreclosure case. It has a standing issue and a notice issue. Second Department, in an extensive decision explaining the relevant issues and analysis in some depth, held plaintiff bank did not demonstrate compliance with the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, section 1304, and did not demonstrate standing to bring the foreclosure action. The court wrote, the plaintiff failed to submit an affidavit of mailing or proof of mailing by the United States Postal Service evidencing that it properly mailed notice to the defendant pursuant to Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304. Instead, the plaintiff relied on an affidavit of Rashad Blanchard, who was employed as a loan analyst by the parent company of the plaintiff's loan servicer, and copies of the purported notices. The plaintiff submitted only one letter that purported to constitute the statutorily required 90-day notice of default. Although the letter contained a statement sent via certified mail with a 20-digit number below it, no receipt or corresponding document issued by the United States Postal Service was submitted proving that the letter was actually sent by certified mail more than 90 days prior to the commencement of the action. The plaintiff also failed to submit any documentary evidence that notice was sent by first-class mail. Further, Blanchard did not aver that the notice was sent in the manner required pursuant to Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304, that is, by certified mail and first-class mail. Moreover, since he did not aver that he personally mailed the notice or that he was familiar with the mailing practices and procedures of American Home Mortgage Servicing Incorporated, the entity that purportedly sent the notices, he did not establish proof of a standard office practice and procedure designed to ensure that items are properly addressed and mailed. Okay, so that gives you some idea of how detailed the requirements are for proof of mailing notice in a foreclosure action. And the next section of the court's decision deals with the proof necessary under the business records exception to the hearsay law to demonstrate standing. In order to demonstrate standing, a bank has to show that it has possession of the note and mortgage at the time that the foreclosure proceeding is commenced. And this is what the court said about that. Vice President Reyes's affidavit failed to establish a sufficient foundation for the admission of a business record pursuant to CPLR 4518 subdivision A, because although he recited that the records upon which he relied were regularly maintained by the plaintiff in the ordinary course of its business, he did not indicate that they were made by their author pursuant to an established procedure for the routine, habitual, systematic making of records that would qualify them as trustworthy accounts, or that they were the records regularly relied on in the business. Reyes also failed to indicate that the record was made at or about the time of the event being recorded. To the extent that Reyes's purported knowledge of the date the plaintiff received the original note was based upon his review of unidentified business records maintained by the plaintiff, his affidavit constituted inadmissible hearsay and lacked probative value. Next is Peter R. Ginsburg Law. On pages 17 and 18, it deals with two different issues, the statute of frauds and the requirements for summary judgment in lieu of complaint. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the invoices submitted by plaintiff do not qualify for a CPLR 3213 relief on the account's stated cause of action because reference to extrinsic evidence was required and defendants were not entitled to dismissal based upon the statute of frauds because there was an allegation of new consideration flowing from plaintiff to defendants. The court wrote, plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in lieu of complaint should have been denied. The invoices do not qualify for CPLR 3213 relief because it is necessary to consult extrinsic evidence aside from the invoices and proof of nonpayment in order for plaintiff to establish its entitlement to summary judgment on its account's stated claim. Plaintiff has failed to establish, based on the invoices themselves, that defendants, as opposed to non-party Impact Sports, are liable based on an account stated claim. Defendants are not entitled to dismissal of the action based on the statute of frauds, that's General Obligations Law, Section 5-701. As a plaintiff has sufficiently alleged that there was new consideration flowing from the plaintiff to defendants, which is an exception to the requirement that a promise to pay the debt for another be in writing. Next is Kessel versus Adams, pages 18 and 19, statute of limitations involving intentional torts. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff teacher's suit against two students alleged intentional conduct, battery, not negligent conduct, and was therefore time barred. Plaintiff was pushed into a locker by the students who were fighting each other. Although the students did not intend to touch the teacher, the doctrine of transferred intent applied. The court wrote, defendant met her initial burden by establishing that plaintiff was injured as a result of intentional conduct that constituted a battery and not negligent conduct. A valid claim for battery exists where a person intentionally touches another without that person's consent. The intent required for battery is intent to cause a bodily contact that a reasonable person would find offensive. There's no requirement that the contact be intended to cause harm. The deposition testimony of plaintiff and defendants submitted in support of the motion established that defendants intentionally caused offensive bodily contact with each other by engaging in a physical fight. Although defendants did not intend to make physical contact with or to injure plaintiff, the contact that resulted in plaintiff's injuries was nevertheless intentional under the doctrine of transferred intent. Defendant thus established that this action is barred by the one-year statute of limitations applicable to intentional torts. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this March 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code is INTENT. Again, the verification code for this March 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE is INTENT. Next is Borriello on page 19. Deals with the criteria for a motion for a directed verdict. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for a directed verdict should not have been granted and explained the criteria. The court wrote, a motion for judgment as a matter of law pursuant to CPLR 4401 may be granted where the trial court determines that, upon the evidence presented, there is no rational process by which the trier of fact could base a finding in favor of the non-moving party. In considering such a motion, the trial court must afford the party opposing the motion every inference which may properly be drawn from the facts presented, and the facts must be considered in light most favorable to the non-moving party. Here, the Supreme Court, in announcing its decision, stated that it expressly considered and relied on the defendant's evidence. This was error, as it was improper for the court to consider on a motion for a directed verdict made before the moving party had rested and the opposing party had an opportunity to present rebuttal evidence, the evidence introduced by the moving party. Thus, in the context of a motion for a directed verdict, the Supreme Court should not have accorded the defendant's expert's testimony more weight than that of the plaintiff's expert. In determining a motion for a directed verdict, the trial court must not engage in weighing of the evidence, nor may it direct a verdict where the facts are in dispute or where different inferences may be drawn or the credibility of witnesses is in question. And finally, the last case, Wells Fargo Bank foreclosure action on page 20, deals with the concept of waiver in the context of a foreclosure. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the defendant in this foreclosure action did not waive his right to seek dismissal of the complaint by participating in a settlement conference. The plaintiff bank had abandoned the action. The court wrote, CPLR 3215 subdivision C states that if a plaintiff fails to take proceedings for the entry of judgment within 1 year after the default, the court shall not enter judgment, but shall dismiss the complaint as abandoned upon its own initiative or on motion. The language of 3215C is not discretionary. and a claim for which a default judgment is not sought within the requisite one-year period will be deemed abandoned. Notwithstanding, a claim will not be deemed abandoned if the party seeking a default judgment provides sufficient cause as to why the complaint should not be dismissed, that CPLR 3215C. Here, plaintiff waited almost 3 years to seek a default judgment, and it failed to provide sufficient cause as to why the complaint should not be dismissed. As such, plaintiff's complaint is dismissed as abandoned. Plaintiff's argument that defendant waived his right to seek dismissal pursuant to CPLR 3215C because he participated in the settlement conferences is equally unavailing. Although a party may waive its rights under CPLR 3215C by serving an answer or taking any other steps which may be viewed as a formal or informal appearance, defendant's participation in settlement conferences did not constitute either a formal or an informal appearance, since he did not actively litigate the action before the Supreme Court or participate in the action on the merits. And that concludes this March 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE.